From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The clock at Arthur Ashe Stadium struck 12 for Cinderella this week, but 17-year-old Melanie Odin's story has only just begun. Ahead on Only a Game, a U.S. Open update, and a look at Odin's tennis future, also taking stock of NASCAR's economic outlook, and remembering Staten Island's high school football rivalry of a half century ago. Also ahead, donut derby bicyclists balance speed with gustatory prowess.
People who ride really hard and have fast times don't eat as many donuts because their stomach's unsettled. And the people who sort of cruise out there can put them away. So it really levels the playing field. It's a nice handicap system.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This year's U.S. Open has seriously tested the patience of the players who've made it as far as the final rounds of the tournament. Thursday night's quarterfinal match between Fernando Gonzalez and Rafael Nadal was suspended by rain, and rain washed out yesterday's matches as well. But what lots of people probably consider the most dramatic story of the tournament transpired before the skies opened up when 17-year-old Melanie Odin swept away three players ranked well above her and made it all the way to the quarterfinals. Joining me now to talk about that unlikely occurrence and other open action is Bud Collins of the Boston Globe and ESPN. Hi, Bud.
Hi, Bill.
Were you as surprised as everybody else by the performance of Melanie Odin, or did you see these upsets of all those accomplished Russian players coming?
If I saw stuff like that coming, I'd be in Las Vegas right now, Bill, not talking to you. But no, I didn't see it, except I knew she was a good player because I saw her at Wimbledon beating Yelena Yankovic. Mm-hmm. And I liked the fact that she moved her feet very well. She was competitive, but she's terribly small, 5'5", and everybody towered above her that she played, but she knocked off four Russians, and I wonder if the Kremlin liked that. But anyway, she was pretty tired when she went out, I think, for her match against Caroline Wozniacki, who's a Dane, and Wozniacki's a very good player, so the thing had to come to an end. But before it did, it reminded me, going way back to 1971, Bill, Chris Evert, mm-hmm. making her debut and at 16 years of age and going all the way to the semifinals before Billie Jean King caught up with her. So there were, and Venus Williams in 1997 when she was unseeded, ranked number 66, and went all the way to the final as a 17-year-old.
It's interesting that you compare Melanie Odin to Chris Evert. Interesting to me because Odin is at her best very steady. What happens when she develops a serve powerful enough so she can win some easy points with aces?
Well, that has to happen, and I think it will with age. She didn't have any serves that reached 100 miles per hour, and so she was on the defensive a lot of the time. But she makes up for it with her quickness, and she really is a competitor. She had the word believe written on her sneakers by her boyfriend, and she did believe, but I think the fact that she got to the quarterfinals was just a little too much.
The woman who beat Melanie Odin, Caroline Wozniacki, plays Janina Wickmayer in the semifinals. Who wins that one?
I think Wozniacki does, but I love Wickmayer because, you know, we have all these screamers in women's tennis. At least her screaming makes some sense. It's, yoo-hoo, yoo-hoo.
But that's something they do on Car Talk. They ask you to make the noise your car makes. That's very good.
I know. It actually... Actually, the noise is whoopee, whoopee.
Terrific. On the other side of the women's draw, Serena Williams appears poised to add still another major to her resume. Do you agree?
I do, but she's beatable, but she rises in the major events, just as she did in Australia this year and at Wimbledon, and she did here last year in winning the championship. She's a very tough customer.
Rafael Nadal needed to go to a tiebreaker to win the first set in his quarterfinal match against Fernando Gonzalez Thursday night. When that match resumes today, they'll begin play in the middle of the second set tiebreaker. Does the long delay favor either player?
No, I think it helps Nadal probably more because, as you know, he had that 10-week layoff to cure the tendonitis in his knees. And this year he's had abdominal problems. He's been stretched out and had to call for the trainer a couple of times. So I think the more rest he can get, the better.
How patient have the fans been with these weather delays, Bud? Were they calling for Thursday night's match to continue despite the showers?
Well, not so much, because the thing that happened was the U.S. Tennis Association goofed. They should have had both those matches during the afternoon session because the weather forecast was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't stand to give up a big admission session, and they got caught.
To nobody's surprise, Roger Federer is still very much a factor in this tournament. He next plays Novak Djokovic in the semifinals. Do you see Federer getting through to the final without much trouble?
Well, I think he'll have some trouble, actually. I think people go after him, and it's not a cakewalk. I thought Andy Murray, was going to do it, but he was very meek and fell very early in the tournament. But you have to make Roger the favorite after all.
Bud, talk to me a little bit about the significance of winning this tournament for Federer, because this is a step into immortality, right?
Well, yes. I mean, he has more major championships now than anyone else, and he now is one of the six men who have won all four major championships over a span of years. So he's just adding really more to his wonderful reputation.
There's also the fact that not so long ago, people were talking about Federer in the past tense, and they were saying Nadal is the future of tennis.
Only a few months ago, Bill. That is amazing, but sports is like that. When he lost to Nadal in the final of the Australian Open at the beginning of the season, after Nadal had beaten him at Wimbledon a few months before that, and people were saying, oh, what's gone wrong? He even got so flustered that he smashed a racket at Indian Wells, which was most unusual for Roger Federer, but suddenly got himself straightened out. Maybe it was the birth of his twin daughters. I don't know, but he looks like a tough man to beat.
Is it your sense that most of the fans would like to see yet another Federer-Nadal confrontation, or would they like to see a Gonzalez or a Del Potro bobbing up in the final?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, Del Potro's a guy who could win this tournament, 6'7", and is a real banger. But I think people want to see Roger and Rafa. I think they've seen it so many times, and they don't get enough of it. And they've never seen it in the U.S. Open.
Bud Collins covers tennis for the Boston Globe and ESPN, and happily for Only a Game as well. Thank you, Bud.
Thank you, Bill.
Tonight in Richmond, Virginia, 10 drivers will vie for the final 8 spots in the chase to the Sprint Cup, NASCAR's championship series. Tony Stewart, Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, and Denny Hamlin have already qualified. On the bubble in 11th place is Greg Biffle, who took time out this week to play video games. Wait, can that possibly be right? Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Uh-oh! Don't hit Biffle, Tim!
It's Tuesday afternoon, and Greg Biffle is iRacing against fans at Game On, a club near Fenway Park, and promoting NASCAR's upcoming race at the New Hampshire Motor Speedway. In tough economic times, NASCAR is doing what it can to drum up fan support and to cut costs. So I can't help but wonder whether drivers will be replacing track time with video time. iRacing.com's Kevin Bobbitt is way ahead of me.
Some of the drivers use it to train. Most of them use it because it's fun and they like to go racing and they cannot get enough racing. You'll find people like Dale Jr. racing Sunday night 2 a.m. after he just had a 500-mile race somewhere else, but he's amped up and ready to go.
Unfortunately for Biffle, he's not an iRacing regular and spends most of the race in the pits.
That's not good.
Before this season began, dire predictions of low turnout, high gas prices, and sponsor cutbacks threatened to put NASCAR in the pits. But Biffle says it hasn't been that bad.
We're real fortunate, NASCAR is, that, and myself, that the sport has really not taken the hit that the rest of the economy has. NASCAR fans are loyal folks. You know, the ticket prices have come down. People have still foregone going for dinner and doing other things, but they haven't missed the NASCAR races as much.
Tracks have dropped prices for general admission tickets by as much as 50%. But exactly how many fans have missed NASCAR races in favor of more pressing concerns is a matter of debate. Even an expert like Sports Illustrated's Pablo Torre can't quite get a handle on it.
I try to figure this stuff out, and NASCAR does not actually release attendance figures for its races. But we can say that, you know, just visually, that the stands are emptier. That's not an optical illusion, unfortunately. Like all sports, they're suffering, but NASCAR especially, you're talking about fans who have to drive, and oftentimes they drive a long way, they have motorhomes, you know. It's funny, NASCAR involves gas on virtually every level of the sport. It's uniquely tied to the auto industry and gasoline and fuel.
Similarly difficult to come by are firm numbers on how many sponsorship dollars have been lost. Torre says all the auto manufacturers have had to cut back on their involvement with NASCAR, including GM, whose investment was rumored to be around $130 million.
The bottom line with NASCAR is that about 80% of a typical NASCAR budget is accounted for by corporate sponsorship. So no matter how well things are doing relative to the recession, the fact is, in a macro sense, you know, corporate dollars are way down, and NASCAR as a sport is so uniquely situated, you know, every car is basically a billboard. It's difficult to say that they're doing well.
Not all of NASCAR's woes are due to the economy. People can still afford to stay home and watch TV, but ratings are down, and there's no hiding those figures. Despite gains over the past four races, NASCAR on Fox has seen a double-digit decline over the ratings from last year. And according to Peter DeLorenzo, publisher of AutoExtremist.com, last year wasn't that hot either.
The absolute peak of the NASCAR boom was probably 2004 to 2007. And nothing that hot can stay that hot forever. And they've been pretty much on a steady decline since. There was a bit of fadism going on. And also, NASCAR did its best to alienate some of its longtime hardcore supporters with some of the moves they made in scheduling and tracks, et cetera, et cetera.
There is good news for NASCAR. A tight race for the chase has fans excited, and Labor Day weekend's night race at Atlanta drew about 111,000 fans, 50,000 more than a race at the same track in March. DeLorenzo isn't surprised to hear drivers like Biffle focusing on the positive.
You know, if you ask the folks in Daytona Beach, the glass is always half full, and most of the drivers will tell you the same thing, but behind the scenes, there's a lot of worrying going on about manufacturer involvement, sponsor involvement. The next TV contract negotiation that comes up will be pivotal. Is NASCAR still healthy today? It's healthy, but with an asterisk, I think.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Chess is a game of strategy, and last Friday in Chennai, India, the player ranked 58th in the world demonstrated that showing up for a match so drunk you can't remain conscious is a poor choice of tactics. Shortly after his match against Privan Kumar began, Grandmaster Vladislav Chaikov, who could hardly stay upright in his chair, fell asleep on the table. Efforts to rouse him were unsuccessful, and Mr. Kumar was declared the winner of the match on the technical ground that his opponent was unable to complete his moves within the stipulated time of 1 hour and 30 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, high school football when you took the Staten Island Ferry or rode out there by yourself. But first, the NFL regular season is underway, and here to discuss which team will go winless in 2009, I don't know, Detroit maybe, or lossless, definitely New England, is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to the program, Dan.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Have I got that prediction about right?
You know, it's possible that St. Louis is actually worse than Detroit. So we might have more than one contender for the O for season, the road to one.
Oh, dear.
But I actually think Detroit will probably win a couple. You know, it's very difficult to go 0-16, and that's why it's only happened once. So I think we'll probably everyone will get a couple wins this year, feel good about themselves. We won't have a total meltdown. As for 16-0, also very difficult. I like New England's chances if you had to pick somebody, except they're tinkering with their defense. They lost a lot of veterans off that defense, so they're probably not capable of doing it. Pittsburgh's probably not capable of doing it. So I think we'll have everyone meet in the middle a little bit.
The Arizona Cardinals were the Super Bowl runners-up last time around. They managed to re-sign quarterback Kurt Warner in the offseason. Does that ensure a return trip to the big game?
Probably not, if history's any indication. The Super Bowl loser, more often than not, I think the last 16 years, misses, and almost overwhelmingly, he actually misses the playoffs the next year. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it happens over and over, and that even includes New England, who went 18-0 going into the Super Bowl, then lost the game, but would appear to be one team that you count on to at least make the playoffs, and then Tom Brady gets hurt in the first game a year ago. So the Cardinals are not a team if you're picking or betting you want to go with. Just historically, something happens with that club.
Dan, I think we have perhaps avoided it for too long, but in the interest of journalistic responsibility, we now have to point out that the Minnesota Vikings are hopeful that 2009 will be a very strong season for them after the addition this offseason of inside linebacker Jasper Brinkley. Can the rookie carry the Vikings to the promised land, or Valhalla, if you will?
Yes, all eyes will be on Jasper. It was a soap opera of back and forth. Would he sign? Would he not? And fortunately, no one paid any attention to the quarterback position. So
Brett Favre could slip in there under cover of night.
I don't even think people are aware that this happened, you know. But Brett Favre and his Wranglers are in Minnesota after what has got to be one of the most unbelievable soap operas in the history of the NFL. I think since retiring last February, he retired and unretired five times. So is an NFL record right there. And, you know, it's always nice to see someone set a record. So he'll take on Cleveland Sunday. Very interested to see what happens with Brett Favre. Does he have anything left? Is he hurting this team? Is he going to give him the spark to improve? Minnesota's a playoff team a year ago. So obviously a lot of attention we paid to Brett Favre even long after he stops playing.
The Bengals, formerly the league's laughingstock, are only eliciting snickers these days, which I suppose makes them the NFL's snickering stock. Anyway, they're showing up in preseason predictions as maybe a wild card team getting to the playoffs. What do you think?
Well, they did the HBO Hard Knocks series, and that got everyone excited about them. I'm not sure they're really that good, but Carson Palmer, their quarterback, is back and healthy. He missed most of last year due to injury, and he goes, the Bengals will go. So I do think they'll be a better team. I'm not so sure they're really a wild card team. Although the one thing is, everything gets mixed up in there. The margin for failure and success is so small, it's possible. But I wouldn't necessarily bet on a wild card, but they are better.
I've also noticed that a lot of pundits think the Chargers are going to do pretty well, get to the postseason. Is this the same team that went 8-8 and barely snuck into the playoffs last year?
Same team, a little healthier. Defense looks to be a lot better, and I think they kind of have a schedule that people like too. So, but yeah, I agree that they're kind of the pick. Here's the problem with the NFL, Bill, is you got about 8 months, and the season never, the off season never ends. So eventually, all 32 teams get overanalyzed, and everyone thinks they're going to make the Super Bowl or something. So, the fans are so, they're so excited about the NFL, and then they have nothing to do for so long. So I think these teams get overanalyzed. But the Chargers should be better. Again, they're healthier, better schedule. Hey, why not?
Speaking of overanalyzed and maybe even considering underanalyzed, are there other teams that we ought to be talking about at this point?
You know, I go back to the Steelers. The Steelers have gotten very little attention in the offseason, and everyone's looking for someone else to win it. I think they're a tremendous club that's capable of doing this. Patriots, obviously, you got Tom Brady back. Not that they're going under the radar. The Colts, I think Peyton Manning is poised. They have a new coach, Tony Dungy's no longer with them, kind of their face of their franchise for a long time with Manning, but I think they're going to be pretty good. Another team I think is going to be interested in the New York Jets. They got Mark Sanchez, their rookie quarterback. Rookie quarterbacks tend to struggle. I don't know how good they're going to be, but I think they're going to be a very, very interesting team. He has looked absolutely tremendous in the preseason. He doesn't look like a rookie quarterback, so he's going to have his moments, but I think they could be a really tough team in the second half of the season, you know, as he kind of really settles into that job.
All right, Dan, this is the point where I ask you to either demonstrate that you are, in fact, a brilliant analyst or that you're just as dumb as the rest of us. Give me the two teams that meet in the Super Bowl and then the winner.
I am going to go with the Steelers and the Saints, and I think the Steelers will win. I think they're going to repeat, but I like the Saints in the NFC, and I like the Steeler team. I think they're going to be focused on winning. They're not going to have that hangover, and I like them better than the Patriots because the Patriots have had some losses on defense. I think when you get down the end, you've got to win championships with defense. I think the Steelers have a better defense. So I'm going to go Steelers over Saints, and you can record that for posterity's sake, and we'll bring it back up in February. And I know you will when I get them both wrong.
Dan Wetzel is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he joins Only a Game from time to time to talk football, pro and college. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Bill.
Late in the fall of 1959, the football teams representing two high schools on Staten Island in New York battle each other in the mud. In a new book, Thanksgiving 1959, Jay Price, who writes for the Staten Island Advance, introduces us to the coaches and players involved in that game. His account of the game is compelling, as is his story of time and change in a particular place off the field as well as on it. Jay Price joins me now from the studios of WWFM in West Windsor, New Jersey. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
High school football is taken seriously in lots of places, particularly Texas, of course. What made it so special in Staten Island 50 years ago?
A lot of that has to do with the time, not just in Staten Island, but in the country. We're talking about a time before television had come into everybody's living room and taken over sports, when a lot of people looked for their entertainment dollar right in their backyard. And on Staten Island, it was one of those places where high school football was the big attraction in the fall, and you didn't have to go to one of those schools to be interested when Thanksgiving came. That's what you did on Staten Island.
The title of the book is Thanksgiving 1959, but it could just as easily and perhaps more accurately have been Sal Soma, football coach. In fact, you begin the book by setting the scene at Coach Soma's funeral back in 1993. Give us a sense of his significance to Staten Island.
Well, if I work backwards a little bit, the Staten Island Sports Hall of Fame, which was a dream of Sal Soma's, got started in 1995. 2 years after his death. And in the first class, I believe we had 11 inductees. We had some All-Americans, Olympic medal winners, Major League Baseball players, golfers from the Pro Tour. Sal Soma was the first inductee introduced because that's how we thought it should be. And to this day, he is still the only one who has ever been introduced out of alphabetical order.
The alphabet be darned, Soma goes in first.
Correct.
You write that Coach Soma had the power to send messages and drive home lessons that no English teacher or assistant principal ever could. I'm quoting there. Why was that?
I think, and this seems an odd thing to say about a football coach, I think it was the example he set. And usually we say that about players, not coaches. But the first words out of every player's mouth when you ask them about Sal Soma was, what a gentleman he was. And that's not a word we often hear, I don't think, applied to coaches, not to Bill Parcells or Bill Belichick, and unfortunately not to a lot of high school coaches either. But he didn't coach by fear. I think it was like plan for your father. Those guys did not want to disappoint him, and that was what it was about for them.
The good lessons notwithstanding, Coach Soma regularly conducted illegal practices before he was supposed to, before the season began, and he encouraged students to fudge their addresses so they could attend the high school where he was the coach. Any qualms about the message he was sending by bending the rules?
To be clear, I don't know that he encouraged students to change their addresses. He may have known in his heart why they were going to school. To clear that up, the technicality was Newdorp was the only high school on Staten Island that offered Italian, and it was a predominantly Italian neighborhood, and it was easy for kids to say that they were going to go to learn Italian so they could speak to their dear grandmother who only spoke Italian.
Even 50 years ago, come on, I'm going to Newdorp so I can learn Italian and speak to my grandmother. Who didn't see through that?
Absolutely. Well, maybe nobody wanted to. But when it came to the rules, there was a story that's not in the book, and it's a very small story maybe, but I think it's analogous to what went on with the starting date in football. You have to remember that this was a guy who grew up dirt poor, and football basically definitely changed his life, if not saved his life. And he was going to give that to kids of the next generation, whatever way he could. Mm-hmm. And the analogy I would make was teachers were not allowed, for very good reason, to medicate students. But if a student came to him and said that they had a terrible headache, he might tell them that students often find at the end of class that there are aspirin at the end of the bleachers. And the student would find those aspirin at the end of the bleachers by some miracle. And that would be his little way of helping a kid who had nothing to do with football. So if having the kids come down to the field and run plays in August gave them a better chance for success in life, that's what he was going to do until somebody told him he had to stop.
And there are some really quite remarkable stories about later success in life in your book. Tell us a little bit about some of those.
To put in perspective what they did later in life, we ought to know where they came from. And we're talking about mostly Italian and Irish sons of immigrants, families where nobody had ever gone to college, and nobody gave much thought to their sons going to college. And Sal Soma gave those kids a reason to dream big, I think. His captain went to West Point, played football at West Point, went to Vietnam, served two tours very admirably there. The center on the 59 team came back to Newdorp to coach, in part to preserve Sal Soma's legacy, I believe. Most of them, I think, would say the same thing that Vic Esposito, who was the last high school player in New York City to play without a face mask, said that Coach Soma had given him a blueprint for life.
For dramatic purposes, Coach Soma needed a foil, of course. Tell us about the man who most wanted to beat him back on Thanksgiving in 1959.
Well, that would be Andy Barbieri. And Barbieri and Soma were high school teammates, college teammates at NYU back in the days when NYU played big-time football. And then they went back to Staten Island, and for 30 years coached against each other in the only game that mattered most years on Staten Island, which was the Thanksgiving Day game between Curtis High School and Newdorp. And they could not have been more opposite. Sal, the tall, quiet, strong, silent type who as we talked about, coached by example. And Andy, short, squat, as I say in the book, spectacularly profane, and ruled his little fiefdom by fear. There was no question about that.
I'm speaking with Jay Price, author of Thanksgiving 1959, and you're listening to Only a Game. At times, it feels as if Thanksgiving 1959 is as much about what Staten Island used to be and what it has become as it is about high school football. Tell us a little bit about how the Verrazano Narrows Bridge changed everything.
Well, I don't think a little bit is the right phrase to use there. The Staten Island that existed before the bridge was built, and one of the interesting things about picking 1959 to do this story was that was the year construction began on the bridge. It's fair to say it was a little bit of country. I like to tell people that not only were there cows on Staten Island in 1959, but there was a herd of cows. Once the bridge opened and connected the island to the rest of the city, each week that went by, it probably got a little bit more like Brooklyn or Queens and indistinguishable from the other boroughs.
One of Staten Island's most famous native sons is Bobby Thompson, who hit the home run that enabled the New York Giants to beat the Brooklyn Dodgers in the playoff in 1951, the so-called shot heard round the world. How did you get Bobby Thompson to write the foreword for Thanksgiving 1959?
I have known Bobby Thompson for probably 35 or 40 years, and I have never known Bobby Thompson to say no to anybody. I wrote him a note down in South Carolina where he lives, and he called me, and then he called me the next night and the next night and apologized that he wasn't getting through the book faster and wasn't getting something back to me faster. And that is in every way who Bobby Thompson is. I mean, the guy who hit that most famous home run has been wondering ever since what all the fuss was about. He is totally unchanged, and, you know, we used the words gentleman before for Sal Soma. You'll never meet a greater gentleman than Bobby Thompson.
Jay, I have deliberately avoided saying anything about which team won the game on that Thanksgiving day back in 1959 on Staten Island when there only were two high schools on the island. I assume that you would prefer to leave the suspense intact.
That would be a wonderful, wonderful thing, Bill. Yes, I would.
Jay Price is the author of Thanksgiving 1959, when one corner of New York City was still part of small-town America and high school football was the last thing guys did for love. It's a long subtitle, but a good one. It's published by Mountain Lion, Inc., and the author joined me from WWFM in West Windsor, New Jersey. Jay, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In celebration of International Literacy Day, which was Tuesday, the Brooklyn Cyclones minor league baseball team hosted a record-setting event with the help of 1,200 adult readers and the 1,200 children to whom they read. In the stands, before the Cyclones played the Lowell Spinners, the 1,200 adults simultaneously read from Go, Dog, Go, a classic children's book. One might have assumed that the 1,200 children would all sit quietly for the record-breaking reading, but in fact there were reports that 38 of those children said they wanted ice cream, and 67 of them announced they had to go to the bathroom.
Don't care if I ever get back in, it's root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame for, it's 1, 2, 3, strikes you're out at the
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a competition for those who like to eat and run, or rather, eat and ride. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Derek Jeter got his 2,721st hit on Wednesday, tying Lou Gehrig's all-time Yankees record. He broke that 72-year-old record last night in New York. He's ahead of some pretty distinguished company, don't you think?
That's the great thing about holding Yankee team records. It's not like holding Washington Nationals team records. The next three people on this list behind Derek Jeter are now Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, and Mickey Mantle.
We've got another baseball record to discuss this week, Charlie. By losing a lot again this year, the Pittsburgh Pirates have guaranteed that they will become the first major league team ever to experience 17 consecutive losing seasons. Given the efforts of such perennial powerhouses as the old Washington Senators and the old St. Louis Browns, does it surprise you that the Pirates are the first team to be so thoroughly unsuccessful?
Well, considering the enormously proud history of the Pittsburgh Pirates as a franchise, it's pretty funny, but it's also pretty sad. And if I were king of the forest, I would take this team away from current management because current management doesn't want to win. It's got one of the most beautiful of the new ballparks. Mm-hmm. It insists on putting bad teams in it. These people have engaged in an act of organized public consumer fraud for at least 10 years. This is an ownership group that should have the team removed from it.
The other experts I've consulted seem to think that the Steelers, the Patriots, the Giants, the Eagles, and the Chargers will be among the top teams in the National Football League this season. I now turn to you for a prediction or two as the National Football League season begins.
Well, I think that the New England Patriots will beat the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl. I think the San Diego Chargers will come to be known as the most overrated team in the NFL this year.
We have often criticized the No Fun League for the ways in which they've earned that nickname, Charlie, but the NFL has shown signs of softening a bit, at least when it comes to making available to TV viewers games that aren't sold out. Have I got that right?
Yeah, you can watch them online after midnight. Isn't that nice of the National Football League?
Yeah, we are not worthy.
So at 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday night before you have to go to work on Monday, and I guarantee you will be watching them with commercials.
This year, the NFL will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the American Football League, several teams of which were eventually absorbed into the NFL. Have you a favorite pre-merger AFL story?
Well, I am, without question, still a bigger fan of the AFL than I ever was of the NFL. This is rather like the remaining bourbon celebrating Robespierre's birthday. I mean, the only reason we have an NFL that's worth watching now is because a thing called the AFL existed. Among my favorite moments, number one, my favorite football nickname of all time, Albert Golden Wheels DuBenyon of the Buffalo Bills. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed the old ballparks like Jefferson Stadium in Houston and Balboa Stadium in San Diego. But I think my favorite one still has to be the New England, then Boston Patriots, having to play a home game in Alabama.
Caster Semenya, who won gold in the women's 800 meters at last month's World Athletics Championships, has withdrawn from today's 4,000-meter race at the South African Cross Country Championships after unsubstantiated reports that testing has determined she has internal testes instead of ovaries. On Friday, South Africa's Minister of Sports said that the athlete's human rights had been violated. Do you agree with him?
Yes, I do agree with her. This is, of course, an area in which there is no regulation at this point because it's simply something that never came up. I think the kind of sub rosa snickering and the sub rosa diminishing of this person as a human being has been really distasteful. I'm not exactly sure what the IAAF is going to do with this.
In a tweet this week, I'm not sure I'll ever get used to saying in a tweet this week, but I'm going to keep trying. Anyway, NBA guard Allen Iverson announced that, quote, God chose Memphis as the place I will continue my career. So, will the Grizzlies become competitive as a result?
Well, we all know that God chose Memphis as the place for Elvis to go to, and God chose Memphis as a place to put Stax records. Mm-hmm. Why can't God choose Memphis as a place for Allen Iverson to go? They're
going
to be an interesting team this year. I got to give them that much. They may not win many games, but they're going to be a lot of fun to watch. Mark Gasol, by the way, Pau Gasol's brother, his life just became a living hell, and he doesn't know it yet.
In the great scheme of NBA rumors, how do you rate the one that has the New York Knicks offering LeBron James his own TV channel if he agrees to come play in New York?
This is the most creative way of getting around the salary cap yet, and I've seen a whole bunch of them. The LeBron channel?
All LeBron, all the time.
That's not going to be one of those Stephon Marbury deals, is it, where he's sitting in front of the camera and...
Weeping.
Imagine, for example, you know, the Rasheed Wallace channel. Would that have to run on, like, Cinemax after 11 o'clock at night?
With a warning.
That's right.
When a fan walked onto the court and kissed Rafael Nadal after he had won his match at the U.S. Open tennis tournament on Tuesday night, Nadal said, quote, for me, it wasn't a problem. The guy was really nice. Are you encouraged that security at pro tennis tournaments only lets nice guys approach the players
now?
I don't think
we can always rely on the people who come out of the stands to confront athletes being nice, regardless of how much of a friend this guy now has in Rafael Nadal. This is, you know, obviously flashes back to the horrible attack on Monica Seles. This was a bad night for the U.S. Open.
Charlie, I know you just love it when we stretch the definition of sports.
Oh, I love it when we stretch it to Wisconsin.
Even when it goes beyond the breaking point. And so I present to you cricket spitting.
The rules are that cricket has to be thawed out. There's no spitting.
Can't be frozen.
No spitting the frozen cricket, no. Brian Johnsrud spit a thawed cricket 22 feet 8 inches at the Central Wisconsin State Fair on Saturday. And a couple of minutes later, his son spat one out 10 feet 5 inches to win his age division.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very impressed by the Johnsrud family. However, I never want to go to dinner at their house.
And finally, Charlie, we were remiss by not mentioning earlier that there is an NFL prognosticator who did exceptionally well last year, and her support staff feels good about her prospects this year as well. Still, she refuses to pick in games that involve the Philadelphia Eagles. Why is that?
Because Princess, the football-predicting camel at the Popcorn Park Zoo in New Jersey, is standing in solidarity with her canine brothers and sisters against the man who's now playing for Philadelphia. Although how they... Did she just decide not to? Or see, what they do is they give her a graham cracker.
She spit out the cracker that said Eagles on it, I guess.
But in other Michael Vick-related news, an animal welfare group is announcing that it's going to donate dog food every time Michael Vick gets sacked or tackled, which I think is a very creative way to handle this situation. And I just hope they don't give any to the Johnsrud family in Wisconsin, because they'll just spit it out.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
You know, camels are noted for their spitting, Bill.
Yes,
so there's a real theme in the show today.
No crickets spitting, no.
Anything. They'll spit anything.
Okay. If you'd like to read my reviews of books we've featured on Only a Game, or selectively listen to past features and interviews, please visit onlyagame.org. This weekend marks the celebration of the careers of the newest inductees into the Basketball Hall of Fame. The class of 2009 includes Michael Jordan, who many regard as the game's greatest player, John Stockton, who must be considered among the NBA's greatest passers, David Robinson, the quietly brilliant center who retired after leading the San Antonio Spurs to a second NBA championship, Utah Jazz coach Jerry Sloan, the only NBA coach to have won more than 1,000 games with a single team, and C. Vivian Stringer, who's approaching her 40th year as a coach in the women's college game. At least two of the inductees feel the honor is premature. When he learned that he'd been voted into the Hall, and what a shock it must have been, Michael Jordan said, "I don't like being up here for the Hall of Fame, because at that time your basketball career is completely over. I was hoping this day would be 20 more years, or actually I'd go in when I'm dead and gone." Jordan is pro basketball's master of multi-retirements. He left basketball at the top of his game to try baseball, retired once more from the Bulls in 1998 after winning three more championships, and subsequently returned to play for 2 years with the Washington Wizards before hanging up his sneakers again in 2003. The notion that he might hanker to play more falls somewhere between ridiculous and pathetic, but his comment does indicate how much the game has meant, and apparently still means, to this celebrated star. Basketball means just as much to C. Vivian Stringer, the still-employed coach who was enshrined with Jordan. "It's a great thing," Stringer said of the honor, "but it's somehow like being able to live through your own funeral. Most careers are probably done when people go into the Hall of Fame. My excitement is still about the young people I work with, seeing them grow each year." According to the measures by which coaches are judged, Stringer has distinguished herself spectacularly. She's the first coach of either gender to lead teams from three different colleges to the Final Four, and her teams have gone 825 and 280. A couple of years ago, she grabbed the attention even of people who don't follow the women's game with a passionate celebration of the all-round excellence of her Rutgers players when they were witlessly ridiculed by Don Imus. It's the appropriate occasion to say thanks again to Coach Stringer for that, and to her four fellow inductees for the excellence they have demonstrated in the games that have delighted us. Monday is National Cream-Filled Donut Day, and so we bring you the story of the Donut Derby, a bicycle race held each Labor Day just outside Allentown, Pennsylvania. The 36-mile event has two mandatory donut stops where a rider can take 3 minutes off his or her time for each donut chambered. It's exactly the kind of athletic event that Homer Simpson would love if he were an athlete, or real. Last weekend, reporter Eugene Sons set out on his bike to get a taste of the competition.
The last time someone brought a box of donuts to you, you probably felt a little guilty if you had more than one.
But imagine if you were in a place where people talk casually about eating a dozen, maybe two dozen. That's what happens at the Donut Derby. And everyone thinks they've got the winning recipe. 15-year-old Jake Hoover bike races all the time, but still eats like a teenager. He's convinced that this is his edge.
I'm fairly iron-gutted, so I'm quite confident in my digestive abilities.
Phil Asempio is riding a tandem with his wife, Sherry. He thinks they will eat a dozen between them. The strategy is simple.
Get to the first stop first, eat donuts till we see a tandem team, and go.
Bob Van Holt is riding with his 13-year-old daughter, Jenny. He's not so worried about winning.
We wait for the fast guys to get out of the way. We take our time. We get to the park. We eat some donuts. Then we kind of have fun with it.
Gwen Hoover says her bike club, the Lehigh Valley Wheelmen, came up with the Donut Derby 7 years ago to bring together two cycling camps. The racers who count the grams on their carbon-framed bikes and the touring riders who think a bakery is the perfect ride destination.
People who ride really hard and have fast times don't eat as many donuts because their stomach's unsettled. And the people who sort of cruise out there can put them away. So it really levels the playing field. It's a nice handicap system.
That's the start!
300 riders queue up at the starting line. There are racers from local colleges who don't seem to have an ounce of fat on them, and guys whose cycling jerseys don't look like they could hold another donut. There are people with fancy, expensive bikes and a few junkers.
Where are the fatty ones? I want those.
Wait, which is which again?
This is low calorie, that's low fat.
12 miles into the course, racers get to the first stop. You don't have to eat donuts, but you do have to stop and get checked in. Bees hover over tables full of glazed Krispy Kremes. Each one is skewered with a popsicle stick. Riders turn in their empty sticks on their way back to their bikes so that the donut marshals can keep track. Discussions about strategy can get pretty garbled as riders down donuts.
How many are you going for?
I'm feeling 10.
10 total or 10 now?
10 now.
10 right now.
How many for the whole day then?
I'm trying to go for Gutbuster Award.
Would that be like 30?
Yeah, 28 was the winner last year. So I don't know if it's going to happen, but I'm going to try.
I rode this race last year, ate 7 donuts, and over 30 riders placed ahead of me. This year, I downed 5 glazed donuts at the first stop and even felt good after getting back on my bike. After eating 4 more at the second stop, double digits beckoned. After I finished my 10th, I got back on the bike. The first 2 miles were tough. 10 glazed donuts were sitting like lead in my gut. Fortunately, they stayed there. I'm not sure if the sugar high kicked in or what, but it got easier with 8 miles to go. I was tired when I crossed the finish line, but not the least bit hungry.
Oh, I just finished. Legs feel heavy. Stomach, not too bad. And I'm done. Woohoo!
It took me a little over 2 hours. With 10 donuts and 3 minutes deducted for each one, my donut adjusted time, or DAT, was 1 hour 36 minutes, slightly better than last year, but 42 minutes behind the winner, Frank Gonzalez, who ate 26. As he put it, 2 dozen plus 2 for good luck. Gonzalez says eating single donuts is a waste of precious time.
What I learned is that air takes up space, so I stacked my donuts up and smashed them down and ate them 4 at a time.
Ed Generos, who ate 20, came up with a strategy by watching the Nathan's hot dog eating contest on TV.
I carried a cup in my jersey and filled it with water and dunked the donuts in the water.
And it definitely helped get them down quicker?
Oh, much quicker. Because all that water absorbs into the donut and it turns to mush.
So you're almost drinking it?
Almost. Very little chewing.
If you're wondering how people can eat a dozen or 2 dozen donuts and ride fast enough to win a bike race, you should meet Joe Skelly. He ate 28 donuts last year and won the Donut Derby. Skelly brings a team of friends each year who ride around him, sheltering him from the wind and letting him go quickly without working so hard.
I ride this race like I'm Lance Armstrong, and that's my team, you know. These guys are here specifically to ride for me. They know that. If they ever have a problem with that, then they're out.
Skelly's big enough that I wasn't going to ask him his weight. College-age racers try to compete with big eaters like Skelly, but often have trouble. Christian Mambelli of the Monmouth University team certainly tried. He and his teammates drank beer in the parking lot while waiting for the results. Mambelli was almost ashamed to admit choking down a dozen.
I'm just drinking the beer now to forget that I ate 12 donuts earlier. You know, but you know, like I've been sticking to a lot of chicken, proteins, beans, salad. And, you know, like I lost a lot of weight this year, and I think I just gained it all back today.
And what do you win if you take first in the Donut Derby? Not much. The Donut Marshals hand out medals to the top three finishers in each age category. And the person who eats the most donuts gets the Gut Buster Trophy, a mountain bike tire painted gold attached to a pair of suspenders so it hangs where a spare tire should. For Only a Game, I'm Eugene Song.
The coveted Gut Buster Award for 2009 goes to Frank Gonzalez, who ate 26 donuts and finished with a donut-adjusted time of 52 minutes and 24 seconds.
Only a Game is produced by Doug Trabu and Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. Special thanks to Peter Fretwell at WWFM in West Windsor, New Jersey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Eugene San's Donut Derby photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Lehigh Wheelmen Club member and Donut Derby founder, Karen Winkler.
I'm in training for the Donut Derby. Hand me another one.
One? Come on, one. Karen, your competition includes athletes who can power down four at a time. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.